Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
To be or not to be? That is the question. No, that's not the question. This is not going to be Shakespeare. This is going to be Judaism. And the real question is not to be or not to be, but to eat kitniot on this Passover or not to eat kitniot on this Passover holiday. If you are Ashkenazi, if your custom, not law, custom or tradition is not to eat kitniot and you're living in the land of Israel, can you eat like your Sephardi neighbors? We're going to be having on Rabbi David Bar Chaim. He's going to talk about what a lot of people are doing today. A lot of Ashkenazim are saying, no more baggage from the exile. We are Jews in the land of Israel. No more Ashkenazi, no more Sephardi. We are just Jews, as we were before we were thrown out of the land of Israel by the enemies who took over, by the Romans. They threw us out. They exiled us. Not everybody, but almost everybody. There were always Jews living in the land of Israel. So that's the question. It's a big, big question here in Israel. We'll get into it later in the show. We're also having on Shifra Hoffman. She's going to talk about her take on why violent Arab terrorist attacks continue with no end in sight, she says. And she wants to talk about saving Israel from further tragedy. And in the last part of the show, if there's time, I'm going to be talking about Aliyah. I put up something very interesting on my Facebook page. You're all invited to go and read it. It's a very short video, under 5 minutes, about a very inspiring Aliyah story of a black man who came and made Aliyah to Israel. Oh, did I mention he's an Ethiopian black man? Did I mention that he's Jewish? Well, it's a very inspiring story. 4 minutes and something. You've got to watch it and then put your comments on my Facebook page. That's my public Facebook page, by the way. You can also join me in the chat room. We are live if you're listening between 4 to 5 p.m. Holy time right here in the land of Israel. Or if it's between, it's morning time, 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. New York time. That means that we are live and you can call into the show or you can join us in the chat room. It's a lot of fun. And I want to say hi to everybody from all over the world who's listening. Let me see if I can see who is listening. I don't know who's listening. I only know where you're listening from. That's it. I don't know who you are, just where. Okay. Anyway, we'll be right back, everybody.
Hey, it's Ari Fulton, Israel News Talk Radio. If you, like me, are sick and tired, if you've had enough of listening to all the anti-Israel lies and propaganda that's being spread online and offline, in the press, in the newspapers, on TV channels, in the newsrooms across the world, tune into my weekly show, Bulletproof, on Thursdays at 5 p.m. as we discover, expose, and completely destroy all anti-Israel lies and propaganda. And we're going to do it with just the truth. As an active IDF reserve soldier, an elite paratroopers unit, I will try to give you an inside look to the opinions of the men and women of the IDF on the situation. Bulletproof will give you the tools. More importantly, will give you the weapons to take down all anti-Israel activists, no matter where you meet them. Tune in every Thursday at 5 p.m. Israel time to Bulletproof on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
Well, it's time for the Jewish Activism segment with Shifra Hoffman. Shifra Hoffman's the founder of victimsofarabterror.org, and she is the director of shuva.net. And she's here to talk about some of the issues in the news, like her take on the violent Arab terrorist attacks that still continue with no end in sight. Welcome to the show, Shifra Hoffman.
Thank you, Tamar. Before we begin, of course, it was, with God's help, the most wonderful in-depth interview, and I've been interviewed a lot all over the world, but yours was a very meaningful one, and I've gotten good feedback, so tada rabah.
I bet you tell that to all the girls. Okay, Shifra, thank you. It was my pleasure and my honor. So the Arab stabbing attack still taking place. We had it over the weekend as well. What do you have to say?
Look, you know, people think that each new attack is something new. If we want to trace the roots, which we should, it goes back all the way back. And the rabbis of blessed memory left us a very important admonition that Esav will always hate Yaakov. It's a law. They made it into a law. The hatred is there, and it can't be wished away, and it can't be whisked away. It has to be dealt with. And, you know, in trying to research where our sources are, because we do need to have the sources for everything that we believe in, we have to look at the Ten Commandments. The Almighty God, blessed be his holy name, he said and left us this word, you shall have no other gods before me. And he also said that you should not prostrate yourself to any god or even a graven image. Why do I use these particular two commandments? Because it seems that our prime minister believes that Lahavdil Elif, no comparison, Donald Trump is God. And so he has to come to him and ask him what to do. Should we build in our own land? How do we deal with the terror? Can you deal with the terror? I'm embarrassed. Every emotion that I try to put down on paper when I write, the only one that comes up is embarrassment. Either we are a sovereign country and we have to do what is good for our people, or we're just a banana republic and we have to wait until Trump gives us the okay. The violence will not stop because the hatred is there and it's embedded in them. Even if they sign a so-called peace agreement, what are you going to do with the individual Arabs like the ones that come out with a knife and stab and kill because they believe that either they're going to their heaven and have 72 virgins or they're going to be honored? And by the way, the Arabs do honor their terrorists and they make them feel like they did something great. On the other side, we who do not do these things and we have heroes who protect themselves, they are not honored, they're usually put in prison, like the soldier.
You know, I think that you can add to that list of where you write down the word embarrassment. I would add to that humiliation, because sometimes the way when I see how our government just laps up like a puppy dog, you know, trying to get the master to pet his head and say, good dog, good dog. It's humiliating.
It is. You're right. In fact, one of my articles, and I'd like to call attention to people who would like to read some of my articles, I myself am amazed that they were written many years ago. It's on the Arucheva opinion page. Also, of course, there are a lot in the Jewish press. And, of course, you can Google to Yoohoo and hear me in person. But what I say what I wanted to say is that I did write an article called The Humiliation of the Jewish People. And it started, it's not only Bibi, it's right wing, left wing, in between. They don't seem to understand. We are a sovereign nation again, and you have to take the action that's going to help our people. These stabbings and the killings and the rock throwings are intense so that we should say, okay, we had enough, we're leaving Israel. That must never happen, never, never, never again. We have to show them not these niceties of, you know, you're not so bad, we'll sit in prison a little bit for a murder and then release you. As a matter of fact, these attacks come right on the heels of when they released that brutal terrorist who was pictured with his hands full of blood when they lynched the soldiers 7 years ago. Any normal country would give them the death penalty. We don't have the death penalty. We do, but we don't enforce it. So they say, okay, you'll sit in prison for a while. You'll get good meals. You'll get education. And then we'll make a deal with the terrorist organization, which I believe is Abu Hamas, whether he calls himself something else or rather. But Abu Abbas is the leader of terror because he sends them or he backs them. And therefore, they have nothing to lose. What we must do now, the Jewish people all over the world, is to demand that the government of Israel start enforcing strict rules. You know, the Bible says an eye for an eye. Well, you don't want to do eye for an eye? All right, sit in prison for life. But I prefer to give murderers murder. They belong in the death cell.
And, you know, people forget that it's the Israeli taxpayers' money that we are supporting them now. So not only do they get an education and we feed them and we house them and we guard them, we educate them. And then, as you say, so many of them get out in these prisoner exchanges, which is a disgusting thing. And, you know, people are already desensitized to it. We're used to it already. So these are all humiliating things.
Right, to know, you know, Tamar, you know that the terrible thing is that people are getting used to it. They turn the page or they turn off the radio. Oh, another murder. Oh, another stabbing. No normal people do that. I mean, even what it's called in primitive nations, they know that when you take a life, there has to be punishment. And I call upon right now, before Pesach, before the holiday of Passover, in which the Almighty, blessed is His holy name, gave the Jewish people freedom. You are free to do what has to be done in your land. We don't make any demands on any other land. We don't ask people to fight our battles. Our soldiers in the thousands died to protect Israel. Stop, Bibi, doing such stupid things, coming to Trump. Please, Mr. Trump, tell us we can build here. We threw the people out of the houses to please you. Let me have at least that. I can build another settlement. But after that, oh, no, no, maybe we won't do any more. Or, Mr. Trump, let's have a statement from you that you are going to fight anti-Semitism. The United States will fight it. What is wrong with us? You don't fight anti-Semitism by the President of the United States when he issues a statement, because the anti-Semites don't care about that. What you do, if you see that you cannot win over them, is to pick up, pack up, and come home to Israel and then fight them.
Aliyah is truly the answer. This is correct. All right, and you also wanted to talk about what you believe must be done to save Israel from further tragedy.
Well, that's number one, is to leave the countries. You know, I don't understand. At first I said, gee, I can't be the only one that says this. There must be other people much smarter and much more learned than me that says that you have to come home now at the end of days, just as the Bible tells the Jewish people, because God gave us the land as He promised. And, you know, when we sit at the Seder table, it's going to be next week, Passover night, God willing, on Monday night, Jews all over the world will sit down, have their Seder, and then they're going to say, L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim. Next year in Jerusalem. Next year they're back in Disney World or in Golden Green or wherever in the world they want to go. But you cannot lie to God. God is giving you the opportunity to come home now with your possessions and be able to build a house or rent a house here in your holy land and do for our people, as I've said so many times, Tamar, do for the Jewish people that which Jews have done for every country on the face of the earth, only to find they were best tolerated and at worst annihilated. And that's what's coming in America. Please look at our Shuva website, www.shuva.net, and see what you decide for yourselves.
Well, you know, I like to say rather than next year in Jerusalem, this year in Jerusalem. And I agree with you. Aliyah is the answer. God wants the Jewish people to be living in our land. And then go visit your old watering places that you grew up in, if you miss it, or you want to go shopping or see your friends or whatever. But this is where the Jewish people belong. And this is where Jews will be strong and be a blessing to the world. Shifra, so you want to give out your website and your phone number one more time?
Okay. The phone number here in Israel is 02-5821-106. Website is victimsofarabterror.org. I would like to add one more thought. You know, many people that I speak to or call me or write to me say, well, we can't have all the Jews coming to Israel. There's no room. So I want to end with something humorous, but it's really not humor. It's meant to tell a story or an analogy.
You have like 60 seconds. Go.
Okay. A little boy went to Hebrew school for the first time. When he came home, the father asked him, what did you learn today? He said, I learned to say Kaddish, the prayer for the dead. The father ran to the rabbi and said, how dare you? The first day in Hebrew school, you teach my son the prayer for the dead? And the rabbi said, don't worry. You should only live so long until he'll learn it. So don't worry about all the Jews coming to Israel. Just come here. There's room for everybody that wants to come. Chag Sameach to all the good Jews and to all the Jewish friends, even non-Jews.
Shifra Hoffman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. And she says it. She shoots from the hip. That's why so many of you love Shifra Hoffman. Tells it like it is, tells the truth. And, you know, sometimes the truth is hard to hear. But really, I think about so many Jews who would be such a blessing if they only came and made Aliyah here to Israel. And if I have time at the end of the show, I'm going to talk about this myself and talk about a Facebook post. Actually, a video and a post that I put up on my Facebook page. You can go check it out, Tamar Yonah, my public page, and leave your comments there for me. Do you agree, disagree with what I wrote? I'll try to read it out over the show. When we get back, we're going to be talking about the big debate. Should Ashkenazim living in Israel drop the isur, forbiddenness of eating kitniot or legumes? That's the question. If you don't know what we're talking about, stay tuned. We're going to have Rabbi David Bar Chaim on, who's going to talk about a new idea. It's not that new, actually, of Ashkenazim eating kitniot on the Passover holiday. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the new Beyond the Matrix, bringing you answers for life and faith with Ira Michelson and Rod Bryant. If you listen in, it's because you decided to unplug and join the real world.
You will not find anyone controlling things from behind the curtain here. No need to click your heels three times. Often imitated, never duplicated. We are Beyond the Matrix. Join us at our new time every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Israel time, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Eat kitniot or not to eat kitniot? That is the question. And that is the question that we're going to be asking on the show today. We have with us Rabbi David Bar Chaim. He is an Israeli Orthodox rabbi who heads the Shiloh Institute, or Mechon Shiloh in Hebrew. It's a Jerusalem-based rabbinical court and institute of Jewish education dedicated to Torah Eretz Yisrael. Welcome to the show, Rabbi David Bar Chaim.
Shalom, how are you?
I'm very well. So for some of our listeners who don't know what kitniot are, why don't we just first define that word and then we can go into the debate?
Sure. The word kitniot refers to legumes such as lentils, beans, and things like rice and corn, as opposed to what is called in Hebrew dagan, which is grain, the five species of grain, which are essentially wheat, and barley, and the different varieties of those two grains, wheat and barley. So kitniot are the things which are somewhat similar to grain, that you can eat them in a way similar to other grains, such as rice and corn, and beans, etc. But they are not considered chametz; they cannot become leaven, and therefore, according to halacha, according to Jewish law, they can be consumed on Pesach.
Okay, and so explain also, in a summary, why Ashkenazim do not eat kitniot or these legumes, and why the Sfaradim do.
All right, well, it is agreed by all, going back already thousands of years, in all our ancient sources of Jewish law, it states explicitly that kitniot, legumes, and things like rice, etc., cannot become chametz. They are not something that can become leavened, and therefore they can be eaten on Pesach, on Passover. And there is no argument about this fact. This is stated explicitly in the Talmud and in all the ancient sources. So the question really becomes, why is it that a certain section of the Jewish people, that is to say the Ashkenazi world, came up with this minhag, this practice, this custom of refraining from eating kitniot on Pesach? Thorough research into this topic provides us with the following information. There are two sources, two types of sources, both from the late 12th century, which discuss this practice. The first source is a statement by Rabbi Elazar of the city of Worms in France, which is also the city from which Rashi came from. And he states that we, that is to say, in his part of the world, we do not eat polim and adashim. He speaks of beans and lentils as something that we do not eat on Passover. Why not, he says? Because there are grains of wheat mixed into these products. That's what he says. In other words, the thing itself, the bean itself, the lentil itself is not a problem, but it is often the case that we find grains of wheat mixed up with them, and that is why we refrain from eating these things on Passover. Because if, of course, you take grains of wheat or barley and you cook them in water as you do with lentils or beans, they become chametz, and that is not allowed on Pesach, obviously. Now, the question is, why did he feel that this was a problem? In other words, why did this reality present itself to him? Why was it that wheat grains were mixed up with the lentils or with the beans? The answer to this riddle, and it is a bit of a riddle, is as follows. In ancient times, there was a two-year crop rotation system. In other words, we all know that if you constantly sow crops in a field and don't allow it to rest, to lie fallow, it eventually becomes exhausted and depleted, and it does not produce a very good crop. So what people used to do in ancient times, until about a little bit over 1,000 years ago, they used to allow half of their fields to lie fallow any given year, and the other half of their fields they would plant, shall we say, with wheat or barley, and then the next year they would switch. The ones that had lain fallow the previous year would now be used for growing the wheat and the barley, and the other fields that were used as pasture would be allowed to lie fallow for 1 year. That system, of course, is not very efficient, because half of your arable land at any time is going to be lying fallow. Around the beginning of the 10th century in Western Europe, countries like Germany, France, England, as opposed to Spain, by the way, which was not the case. What I'm about to say does not apply to Spain, because the climate is different and the agricultural system was different. In those countries, such as France and Germany, they came up with a new system, a triennial crop rotation system, which means that in year one, they would plant wheat, shall we say, in a given field. The next year, it would not lie fallow. They would plant beans or lentils or similar legumes in the earth. And the third year, it would lie fallow. And this means that only a third of your arable land is going to be lying fallow any given year. The reason for planting legumes in the field after having used it for wheat is because things like lentils and beans have a very interesting property. They trap the nitrogen in the soil, in the roots of the lentils or the beans. The roots trap nitrogen in the soil, which of course replenishes the soil. That's what fertilizer is, basically, it's nitrogen. And this, of course, improves the quality of the soil. So this new system was invented and developed in the 10th century. From about the year 950 onwards, this is what was going on in Western Europe. The corollary of this is that when you harvest a field of wheat 1 year, of course, some grains of wheat are going to fall onto the ground and not get picked up. That's normal. And sometimes the following year, some of those stray grains of wheat or barley will sprout and grow together with the next crop the following year, shall we say, the lentils or the beans. And that explains why in Germany, for example, where this statement was made, this explains why they claimed that they would find these grains of wheat in their crops, their crops of lentils or beans, and this is why they refrained from eating these substances, these foods on Pesach. That's one explanation, which, even though it has some historical, agricultural, and objective basis to it, it was known by other halachic authorities, and they rejected this claim out of hand. People such as Rabbeinu Asher and his son, Rabbeinu Yaakov, the author of the famous halachic work, The Tur, they were also from Germany, and they knew about this, and they said this is an extreme stringency, and they rejected this idea. This is one explanation. The other explanation is a very different explanation, and it comes entirely, it's written in five or six different sources, but it's always from the same part of the world, that is to say, France.
Okay.
There, several medieval halachic authorities make the claim that kitniot, things like legumes and beans, etc., although not being real chametz, are some kind of minor or secondary form of Chametz, which is a very unusual idea. There's no basis for it in the ancient literature and the ancient sources of Jewish law, but this is the claim. This claim, although it appears in a number of sources as being the reason, the rationale for this practice of not eating these things on Pesach, this too was rejected by a vast majority of the great halachic authorities in that part of the world, in France, in northern France, in southern France. It was rejected out of hand. For example, in the south of France, in the 1300s, there was a great halachic authority called Rabbeinu Yerucham, and he was aware of this custom, and he writes about it in these words. In Hebrew, he says it's a minhag shtut, which means it is a silly and baseless practice.
Okay. And so, you know, I know that you're writing, or maybe you've written it already, but last time I spoke with you, you were writing a Sidur, which was a prayer book, not Ashkenazi or Sephardi, as people tend to use today, but one for Jews who live in the land of Israel. And in so doing, the customs of Jews, which means Kitniot, it's the same thing, should also be that we are here in Israel. We leave our baggage of the exile behind, whether you're Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Persian, Jew, whatever kind of Jew you are, now we're home in Israel. We let that baggage go and we eat and we practice accordingly. Do you want to expound on that really quickly?
Yes, well, as you very correctly and precisely have summed up my position, I agree with you entirely. I think that both for reasons of practicality, for the reason that according to halakha, when a person emigrates to a different country, the customs that were prevalent and were binding on the Jewish community where he comes from originally, when he moves now to a new place where that custom is not binding, is not in existence, he does not have to continue that practice. That's another reason. And the third reason is that we have to focus, I believe, on not just on continuing without end, without any end in sight, the reality of the galut, of the exile, whereby different Jews from 1,000 disparate communities are doing their own thing and don't really feel a total and thorough connection to other Jews who have different practices or different, or as you say, different sidur, different prayer book. We have to focus more on reconstituting the Jewish nation, the Jewish people, here in Eretz Yisrael. And in order to do that, we have to do two things. We have to, as you mentioned, we have to work towards a common Sidur, a common prayer book, which is something that I'm working on, and I hope perhaps by the time we speak next year, it will be ready.
Please, God.
And the other thing is to work towards a standardized halachic system for all Jews living in the land of Israel.
Right, and so we're going to be taking a break now, but I'd like you, if you can, just to stay on the line with me, because I want to ask you a very important question, and that is that some rabbis disagree with you, and some people are afraid. They think it's a sin, and maybe they'll say, well, we need a Sanhedrin, we need a big Jewish court to change the customs. So you'll answer those questions when we get back.
There was a time you didn't worry about terrorism. It was something that happened in a faraway place or to someone else. But now you want to know. Now you want to understand. Now you're afraid that you might be in the danger zone. You need to listen to Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone every week, where you will find out the truth about what is going on in the world around you. Gadi Edelman on The Danger Zone, right here on Israel News Talk Radio.
Or not to eat kidney oat. That is legumes and like beans, corn, rice, things like that. According to Jewish customs, the Jews who were more in the European regions of Europe did not eat these things. The Jews who were from the Sephardi Jews from the Arab countries, etc., did eat these things. And even till today, Jews are keeping these customs. And Rabbi David Bar Chaim says, you don't have to keep these customs anymore. We are now back in Israel. There are no more Ashkenazi Asfaradi. We are simply Jews back home. And my question to you, again, as I said, Rabbi Bar Chaim, there are a lot of people who are saying, but, you know, it's forbidden. My family has never done this. How can we just drop it? We have to have a big Sanhedrin, a big court of rabbis to be able to drop such an important custom. What do you have to say about that?
Well, briefly, I say as follows. In this case, we do not need a Sanhedrin or any such higher Jewish court of law to do away with this custom of not eating kitniot on Pesach. And the reason is that the vast majority, about 95% of the great halachic authorities of the medieval period who were aware of this custom, sometimes in their own areas, came out against it. I mentioned before the Rosh, and I mentioned Rabbeinu Yaakov Balaturim, and I can also mention Rabbeinu Yechiel Miparis, and I can also mention Rabbeinu Yerucham, and I can mention Rabbeinu Shmuel Miplais, and the list is very, very long. Almost all the Rishonim, all the early halachic decisors of the medieval period who were familiar with this custom, considered it to be a mistake, an error. The question as to where this error comes from is an interesting debate, but we probably don't have time for that today. But the fact is, I gave you before two explanations. With regards to the first explanation, that there was an admixture of grains of wheat in the legumes, this is very possibly was an objective reality, but that's not a reason not to eat them on Pesach, because one can simply check the lentils and the beans before you cook them on Pesach.
Which we have to do even today still.
To search, to look for insects, the eggs of bugs, which sometimes are found in these foodstuffs, and to simply because there are things like pebbles or other things, dirt, that you don't want to be cooking in your pot of lentils or beans or what have you. And
right.
Therefore, we always check rice and all these things before we cook them. To check and remove any grain that may appear of wheat is a very simple thing, and this is exactly why it was rejected by many of those authorities. With regards to the other rationale, which is that it's a secondary form, a minor form of chametz, this is a very strange idea. It contradicts completely the oral tradition, the Trasha Baal Peh of the Jewish people, which is thousands of years old. And it even smacks a little bit of a Karaite custom, because amongst the Karaites there were those who had such practices of refraining from eating cooked beans and the like on Passover, because they don't have a very clear definition of chametz, not following the oral tradition. They don't really know how to define chametz. This is why some of the Karaites even did not eat things like yogurt on Pesach, because it's chamutz, because it's fermented. Anything that was fermented in any way, they considered to be chametz, which is, of course, not according to halacha. And when a custom is based on an error, an understanding of the halacha, or some other kind of error which creeps into the system, such a custom is not valid. It has no halachic validity, and therefore does not require Sanhedrin to be nullified.
Okay, because a lot of people feel like they're going to go to hell if they switch over and start to eat kitniot here in Israel.
I very much doubt that, because, as I said, this custom at best is based on some kind of confusion or error. As many of the Rishonim already, the early authorities already point out, it's based on some kind of error. That's number one. Number two, we're talking about Jews who no longer live in Europe. A custom is a localized phenomenon, according to halacha. It is a localized phenomenon which is relevant and binding in a certain area when you live in that area. But if you move away from that area, so Jews whose ancestors lived in Poland or Hungary and today live in Israel or New York are no longer required really to follow those customs, because they've moved to a different part of the world, and there they are allowed to redefine the customs according to which they function. That's the basic halachic stance regarding customs in general. But of course, I do want to point out that there's no requirement to eat kitniot, to eat rice, to eat corn, to eat beans on Pesach. If a person doesn't want to, That's okay. That's fine. But I'm pointing out that in actual fact, there's no reason not to. And on the other, on top of that, I'm pointing out something further, that there is also a benefit to be gained by doing away with this particular custom and many similar customs, because in my view, as I said before, we need to focus today, to concentrate on reconstituting the Jewish people and creating unity within the Jewish people, and therefore avoiding things which cause division. And it's clear that this kind of custom causes division. And I'll give you a practical example, something that I just heard with my own ears just 2 or 3 days ago. A couple, a mixed couple, a mixed marriage, that is to say, an Ashkenazi husband and a Sephardi wife. They were invited by her parents, the wife's parents, Sfaradim, to spend some time with them over Pesach. And he says he can't go because they eat kitniot in their home. And how can he eat kitniot? He can't eat at their table on Pesach. And his parents-in-law are very upset, and the wife is very upset. My point is, those who claim that these customs are okay and they do not cause division, well, this is not true. Here we see and have to deal with a real-life example, and I'm sure there are many thousands of such examples. It does cause division. It causes strife. It can cause marital tension and strife. It can cause arguments, etc. And all these things are unnecessary. And on a much larger scale, that's on the micro level. On the macro level, the Jewish people has to look for ways to act and reconstitute itself as a people rather than continue living in the Galut exile-based mode of disparate communities.
You know, talking about custom, the difference between custom and law, there's another custom that you were telling me about during the break, about when we lean to our left during the Seder. So why don't you quickly talk about that?
Well, already in ancient times, in the Mishnah and the Talmud, we see there is a concept called Haseba. Haseba means reclining, literally. And what this means is as follows. In the ancient world, in many parts of the world, not just in the Jewish world, this was true for the Persians and the Jews and the Greeks and the Romans, when they sat down to a meal, certainly wealthy people and middle-class people, they did not sit down on the ground, they did not sit on chairs as we do today, they reclined on couches. There were special kinds of couches that were rose up on one end, so you would lie on it on your left side, and at one end you would be raised higher where your head was. You would be raised higher than your feet, and they would eat in this position, in a position of this semi-reclining. This is how it was done. This is how it was done in many parts of the world in ancient times. Sometimes it was done quite literally on the floor. They would lie on the floor on mattresses with cushions, and this is how they would spend hours together at a banquet, at a meal, discussing, etc.
Yeah, that doesn't sound so bad.
Not a bad thing. The thing is that because we are not used to this, and we do not do this, and we don't have the proper equipment and furniture for such an exercise, people think today that by sitting on a regular chair as we have today and then bending their back to the left, they are performing the mitzvah of Haseba. And this is what I'm trying to clarify. This is not true. There is no mitzvah at all. There is no purpose, no halachic purpose, no religious significance to sitting at the table on Leila Seder and drinking your wine or eating your matzah whilst bending your back towards the left. The only thing you will achieve with almost complete certainty is spilling some of that wine on the floor, on your shirt, and possibly you end up with a backache. But
okay.
There is no halachic purpose to such a practice. This is already was pointed out by some of the greatest halachic authorities of the Middle Ages, going back 900 years. People like the Ravan and the Ravya, and as quoted in the Tur, this was the standard practice amongst the Ashkenazim.
So Rav, we're going to be running out of time. I just want to ask you. So instead of leaning to the left, what are you telling people to do?
In essence, you're not required to lean or do anything special, but if one wants to signify this is a special night, Leila Seder, then one can take a cushion or some kind of a pillow and put it on one's chair behind one's back in a way that's comfortable, in a way that's somehow more special and a bit different from the usual, shall we say, Shabbat meal.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not required, but that's a nice idea if possible. But
okay.
To sit and break your back bending to the left, this is simply something which has passed from the world because this is no longer has any significance. Today, of course, if you ask what is the President of the United States or the Queen of England, how do they sit when they eat their meals, you won't find them sitting
reclining
back to the... reclining on couches. If that was still the case, then it would still perhaps be relevant to us if we also did so.
Okay, Rav, I'm sorry, I have to, just one last question because we're going to be going. Are there any other Ravanim, respected Orthodox rabbis, who agree with you, or are you the only one saying this? I have to ask this question for our listeners.
There most certainly are other Ravanim. I can't give you names offhand. I don't want to quote people's names without their permission.
Okay.
But I know that there are many Ravanim.
Okay,
And I also know that the Ravanim would disagree, and that's the way of the world.
Okay, all right. Very good. Your website again? Give it out to people.
My website. The website is machonshiloh.org. That's machonshiloh.org. And we have a YouTube channel called Machon Shiloh, also called the Torah Nation, Machon Shiloh. But if you just punch in my name, David Bar Chaim, you'll find it. There are hundreds of video lessons and talks in Hebrew and English.
All right. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I want to wish you a happy Passover, Rav.
Pesach Sameach. Happy Passover to everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you. All right. Well, there goes the debate. You can ask your rabbi. You can, you know, take what you like, leave the rest. You can leave your comments on the webpage where the show is podcast as well. We'll be interested to read your thoughts on this. Thank you, everybody. We'll be back tomorrow, 8 p.m. Israel time, 1 p.m. New York.
If you love Israel News Talk Radio, then you'll love our Facebook page. We keep you up to date on what's happening in Israel, plus little surprise treasures that we don't share on the radio. Go now to follow us on Facebook. Just look for the Israel News Talk Radio Facebook page, and don't forget to subscribe and follow us by clicking on the like button. We post great stuff there that you'll want to share. Israel News Talk Radio on Facebook and Israel News Radio on Twitter.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.